623, 801, 796.
These cryptic sounding numbers, read by KCUR's health editor Dan Margulies, are a little morbid. They actually represent deaths. Statistics from the Missouri Department of Health and Human Services on how many white, non-Hispanic men between the ages of 45 and 64 have died in Kansas City, Missouri, year to year, since 1999. He was looking into those statistics because of a national study showing that the mortality rate for this group, middle-aged white people, has been going up across the country. That's at the same time as everyone else's mortality rate has been going down. Everyone else. Think about that for just a second. Why would one lone group, a group that most people associate with privilege, see an increase in the death rate while the overall trend moves in the opposite direction? Experts point to three main causes: suicide, alcohol, and drugs. I'm Gina Kaufman. Today on KCUR's Central Standard, we're going to get some local insight into this national issue. Let's start with Dan Margulies and those statistics he was just sharing. Dan, good morning.
Morning, Gina.
So, first of all, recap for us the finding of the national study.
Sure. This was a study that made quite a splash when it came out about a month or so ago, and it was co-written by a husband and wife team of economists from Princeton University, Angus Deaton and Ann Case. Deaton just happened to have won the Nobel Prize for Economics this year. Anyway, it created quite a stir because while the statistics were out there all along, nobody, I guess, had bothered to aggregate them.
Or make a narrative.
Yeah, so drawing on figures from the Centers for Disease Prevention and Control and other sources, Deaton and Case found that for white middle-aged Americans from 1999, onwards, the death rate has gone up and gone up very significantly in contrast, as you said, to other racial and ethnic groups where the death rate has either held steady or gone down. Specifically, we're talking about Americans between the ages of 45 and 54. And more particularly, we're talking about middle-aged white Americans. And more particularly than that, middle-aged white Americans with a high school education or less. So as you say, the data is very anomalous, and the question is, why is this happening? And they have suggested that, you know, the suicide rates and the mortality rates from alcohol and substance abuse are greater in that group than in other groups. But of course, that begs the question, why? Why are suicide rates higher? Why is alcohol abuse greater? Why is substance abuse more frequent in this particular demographic group? And that is the $64,000 question.
$64,000 question. Well, so what exactly did you look up to see if the local trends follow those national patterns?
Right. So just to see if indeed the findings hold true at the local level, I dug into vital statistics for Kansas City on both the Missouri side of the state line and the Kansas side. And just to give you some sense of what I found, again, I wasn't able to quite take the criteria where they should be because there are these drop-down menus that you have to go to when you go to the Missouri Department of Vital Statistics. And the narrowest demographic range that was closest to the one we're talking about here over there was 45 to 64, but close enough. So on the Missouri side of the state line, Gina, beginning in 1999, I looked up all causes of death for white Americans, non-Hispanic white Americans, between the ages of 45 to 64. And here's what I found. In 1999, there were 1,351 deaths. In 2013, the last year for which these data are available, there were 1,887 deaths from all causes. That is a 40% increase. Now, the population since 1999, of course, has increased, but it has not increased to that extent, not by a long shot. So indeed, the local data seems to track the national data.
Talk to me a little bit about the discrepancies from one municipality to another within the greater metropolitan area.
Well, I didn't really see great disparities, but I had to look up the Kansas side by county separately. And what I noticed, interestingly enough, was while the mortality rate in Wyandotte County for this particular demographic, namely 45 to 64 non-Hispanic white males, had increased, it hadn't increased nearly as much as it did in Johnson County, which was somewhat counterintuitive to me. As to why that might be the case, I really don't have any answers.
So, as editor of the Heartland Health Monitor, where news stories about health and health policy come across your desk every day, were you surprised by any of this? I mean, does your familiarity with the lay of the land around here provide you with some context the rest of us may not have?
No, I'll tell you, I was just as surprised as everybody else when the Deaton case study came out and started getting all this publicity. Because, you know, even if we assume, as some people are, that part of the reason for this higher mortality rate among this particular demographic is owing to economic insecurity that seems to have arisen in the same time period.
Linked perhaps to that less than a high school degree or less.
Correct. Right.
Yeah.
It doesn't hold true in other parts of the developed Western world, where this same demographic, the mortality rates have gone down. It seems to be particular to Americans. So it's very hard to understand what is going on here. I mean, there is, you know, Paul Krugman, the New York Times columnist and another Nobel laureate in economics, has suggested that at least part of the reason for this increase in mortality is owing to what I called economic insecurity and the dashing, if you will, the American dream for this particular demographic. Another New York Times columnist, the conservative Ross Douthat, has suggested that it has to do with the bowling alone phenomenon that has been pointed out, the sort of alienation of this group from society at large, the fraying of communal and religious bonds. I mean, all kinds of explanations are being advanced. I should point out also that it has been noted by some of the critics of the Deaton case study that there are more Americans now in this demographic, i.e. 45 to 54, who are over 50 years old compared with pre-1999, owing to the baby boom bulge. So that would account in part
just that this is a big group.
Yeah, it's a bigger group. And of course, the older you are, the more likely you are to die, obviously. So some critics are saying, no, this is more apparent than real. But actually, even when you take that population bulge into account, it still does not account for the increase.
Well, let's see if we can get some answers. I'm going to turn now to Jerron St. Ange. He has a double appointment at KU where he teaches in the School of Health Policy and Management, as well as the Department of Sociology. Jerron's going to come at this from a big picture standpoint. Hi, Jerron.
Hello.
What was your initial reaction to these findings?
I guess my initial reaction was that it was surprising, just as Dan said. It's surprising to see because we have this assumption that as we continue to move through time, that we assume that death rates are going to come down. And if we look at what this idea that we're continuing to control our capacity to control disease, that we assume that we're not going to see these upticks in certain types of disease, with the exceptions of maybe some infectious diseases that might come back that we haven't seen in a while. So when we think about it from a demographic perspective, the diseases that we've been talking about primarily have been obesity. So when we think about diseases such as heart disease or cancer or diabetes, I wouldn't have been surprised to see one of those upticks, but to see something in drug poisonings or alcohol poisonings and suicide a little less shocking, but the other ones were a bit more shocking.
So does it surprise you to learn that this increase in the death rate is specific to this particular demographic? I mean, that it's middle-aged white Americans within a certain education range?
I think so. I mean, because just this idea that, so if we think about death rates coming down over time, the idea is that as we continue, as I just mentioned, this idea that we control diseases, so moving away from infectious diseases to more chronic conditions where we have more control over our diseases, What we've been continuing to see over time, though, is that with that capacity to control disease, we're actually seeing increasing disparities. But what I mean by disparities are just those differences in health outcomes and mortality in this case. But we usually see those along ethnic divides. So we see those that majority groups tend to have better death rates than minority groups. But in this case, we really see it playing out not by race-ethnic divides, but really by socioeconomic status divides and primarily by education as found in this study. So I think that's surprising, but not surprising. Surprising in that it's not along those race-ethnic divides, but not surprising that it's by education groups.
Edward Ellerbeck is also with us from KU. He's the chair of preventive medicine and public health at KU Med, and he'll be speaking from the trenches, as it were, from experience with patients at the hospital. Good morning, Dr. Ellerbeck.
Good morning.
What about you? Are you surprised?
Well, I think we've had a little bit of discussion over the underlying or the root causes of this, the socioeconomic factors, but there are clearly some more proximate causes that are pretty evident from the literature. And in particular, that relates to the high number of opiate deaths and deaths related to heroin. And those are actually very closely related. We know that lots of individuals get started on opiate therapy for some chronic pain syndrome, and then when they come off of that therapy or they can no longer get those drugs from a physician or from friends or relatives, they frequently will turn to heroin. And so there's been a huge increase in the proximate cause of these deaths related both to a prescription drug overdose and heroin overdose.
So are you saying that from your experience, especially when it comes to not just drugs as a cause of death, but specifically opiates and heroin, that the study actually kind of resonates with what you see in your practice?
I think so. There's been a cultural shift. About 20 years ago, there was a huge emphasis on trying to control pain for patients. In fact, everybody's gone into a doctor's office and they've had this 1 to 10 pain scale. Where are you on this 1 to 10 pain scale? And the classic answer is 11.
Really? I thought it was 7.
Well, and then what happens is in the effort to respond to that, we know that opiates can provide some short-term pain relief. And unfortunately, that's really all we know. There really are virtually no studies on the benefit of opiates beyond 6 weeks. And yet we have millions of people around the country who are now receiving opiates for chronic pain. And so there's just so many more opiates out there. People are getting them from friends, relatives, they're sharing them, et cetera. But there's just a lot of opiates out in the community.
So can you explain really explicitly how that relates to the findings of this study?
So when they actually looked at the proximate causes of death, and they identified three things. First was cirrhosis, and that wasn't the biggest one, and that appears to be related to the increased consumption of alcohol. And then there were also suicides, and then the third one was the drug overdose. And the drug overdose is the one that's had the most dramatic increase over the last 15 years. And when they break that apart, and the CDC's done some of this in the past, they've broken it apart and they've seen dramatic increases in deaths related to prescription opiates. And that would be things like oxycodone and morphine, and then also related to heroin.
You sound the least surprised by this finding. And I wonder what has taken the people who aren't working directly with patients so long to notice what was maybe a little clearer to you.
Well, I think partly it's a framing issue. When we think of somebody dying of a prescription drug overdose or a heroin overdose, we think that's somebody else. When it's framed in terms of deaths of white, middle-aged Americans, all of a sudden that's coming close to home. And actually, once we start peeling this back, we realize that a lot of these people are close to home. Many, many Americans know people who are on chronic opiate therapy. They know children who've gotten into the drug cabinet or adolescents who've gotten into the drug cabinet. And increasingly, unfortunately, people know of people who've died of prescription drug overdoses. There's also a chicken or the egg phenomenon here. There's some underlying increase in disability and chronic pain in these surveys, and that can be treated with opiates, but it's also possible that the opiates are actually making that factor worse. There's some data to suggest that opiates can actually increase the body's sensitivity to pain. So once a person gets started on opiate therapy, they may be more likely to have chronic pain in the future.
It is interesting to me that you see opiates being so closely tied to this larger issue. I mean, the drug piece of it is one of the three main causes. There's also suicide. Do you see suicide as having a relationship to this use of opiates?
That's possible. It's possible that the opiates could be relating to chronic pain, depression. We know that drug dependency is part of the problem. But then that also does bring us to understanding the overall root causes behind this, which may be the depression, the workplace dissatisfaction, the lack of economic opportunity, legal troubles, socioeconomic difficulties.
Dan Margulies, you wanted to jump in here?
Yes, I just wanted to ask Dr. Ellerbeck this question. Why would this opioid effect that you're describing be largely confined to people with a high school education or less?
Well, so the opioids are used for treating chronic pain. Now, why do people have chronic pain? People are much more likely to have chronic pain when they have workplace dissatisfaction, when they're depressed, when they're not sleeping well. A lot of the things that you've already described can actually lead. And this is why I described this question of which is it, the chicken or the egg, which came first?
Very interesting.
Jaron, talk to us about possible social causes for an increase in the death rate for any cause of death among this particular group. Middle-aged
Certainly.
White Americans.
Well, I think the other thing that Dr. Ellerbeck was hinting at as well is that when we think about pain management and who has access to these medications and who doesn't have access to these medications, whether through insurance or whether through how doctors are actually prescribing drugs by race, ethnic groups, I think that's another component of this. But I think, I mean, broadly speaking, if we think about the economic situation, which clearly plays out across race, ethnic groups, but also thinking about with that economics coupled with issues such as social isolation. And so kind of coming back to this idea that Dan mentioned about social capital or this idea of having trust or having strong social networks. When we look especially at rates of suicide, part of what's going down among what's happening among non-Hispanic whites is that you're finding fewer social ties, fewer strong social networks that might lead to this kind of breakdown. And you couple that with these high levels of addiction, lower levels of services, increased medicalization, or just this emphasis on pain medications, and you can just see this confluence of factors coming together.
So there are three pieces of information we have about this group. We know education level, age, and ethnicity. So from a public health standpoint, what does education level have to do with these three main causes of death that experts have been pointing to, suicide, alcohol, and drugs?
Economic problems.
Yeah,
plain
I would agree
and simple.
With that. I would agree with that. I mean, I think the findings of about suicide weren't all that surprising. I think we've known that for a while, particularly.
But why doesn't that surprise us? I mean, in a way that I feel like that should always
us. Well, I mean, it's shocking, but not surprising in that it's been well publicized. But what the Deaton case study does is bring to the fore a phenomenon that I think we may have been aware of only at a subliminal level. Namely, this sort of alienation, if I may engage in a bit of sociology here, of this particular demographic group, which we witness in our political arena all the time now. Now, whether the polarization of our politics is a symptom or a cause is another interesting question and probably a grist for another show entirely. But this demographic in particular has long been known to be alienated and, some sense that the American dream, they're no longer a part of it, that their children's lives are not going to be better than their forebears' lives and their grandchildren's lives. So, you know, I mean, that seems like a somewhat glib explanation for a higher mortality rate. But many studies have shown the correlation, if not causation, between the two.
What about age group, Jaron? People between the ages of 45 and 54. What's particular about this age range?
You have an age group that's moving through. So part of it is picking up on that tail end of that baby boom generation. There's been some suggestion about just the frequency, and Dr. Ellerbeck mentioned this as well. The frequency of drug use and sharing medications could be part of it. But I think it's getting back to the study that Dan's mentioning. I mean, it's really this prime working age And this idea that poverty is really seen as a moral failure in a lot of sense, that the way that it's framed, it's often this idea of personal responsibility, right, in terms of kind of economic success. So if you're not succeeding, there's this real moral failure, which leads back into some of these issues. Now, is that specific to this age group? I'm not exactly sure, but I think it really plays out in terms of this age group because these are your prime working years.
You know, this might be in some ways the same answer, but what could whiteness have to do with this? I mean, so many people do associate whiteness with privilege. So in a way, that's also a little counterintuitive.
I think Jaron was pointing out this just a little bit or hinting at it when he suggested that whiteness increases your ability to access prescription drugs, which is one of the underlying causes here.
Jaron, why do we break down statistics along sociocultural lines?
Because it's meaningful, right? I mean, if we think about this, when we think about what is it that leads to differences in mortality, it's this idea that our life conditions in some cases may enhance our health or in some cases they may undermine our health. And by life conditions, I mean just these social factors, whether it's education, whether it's living conditions, whether it's social experiences, whether it's culture, all of these different factors, they underlie those fundamental causes of health and this ability to make healthy changes or healthy choices or in some cases limit our healthy choices.
We're going to have to take a quick break, but when KCUR's Central Standard returns, we'll hear a little more on the doctor's perspective. Later in the show, are there major gaps in mental and behavioral health care access in our area? That's coming up. Stay tuned. I'm Gina Kaufman, and you're listening to KCUR's Central Standard. Today, we're discussing local and national statistics showing a spike in the mortality rate for middle-aged white Americans with a high school degree or less, but just them, no one else. Our guests are KCUR's Dan Margulies and KU Med's Jaron St. Ange and Edward Ellerbeck. I want to spend a little more time talking with Edward right now because he comes in direct contact with patients, so he knows on a really intimate level what people out there are struggling with. Edward, talk to me a little bit about what you do.
I chair the Department of Preventive Medicine and Public Health, and so I was very impressed with Dan's epidemiologic description. He needs to be a professor in our department. But I also
love to share him.
I also practice general internal medicine at the University of Kansas.
So who are your patients?
I see adult patients across the spectrum of diseases.
So for anything and everything. You mentioned earlier that you weren't surprised to see mortality rates for middle-aged white Americans within a certain socio and economic range climbing due primarily to suicide, alcohol, and drugs. What specifically do you see in your practice that's consistent with this trend? You talked about opiates. Anything else?
Really, the opiates is a huge, huge underlying factor. And when you think of the proximate causes of death, it's the one where we could really make a difference, where we could be much more judicious about our choice of who receives opiate therapy. And interestingly enough, Missouri is the only state in the country that doesn't have an opiate tracking system in place. And I think there will be some legislation about that coming up this year to try to correct that factor. But it makes it very difficult for a physician when he's treating someone for acute or chronic pain to find out what they've actually received in the past.
And Dan, I believe that's something KCUR has done some reporting on, right?
Yes, our very own Alex Smith has done some extensive looking into that. Missouri, indeed, is the only state in the entire union without a prescription drug database. And there is no logical reason for it. I don't understand why the state has been so obstinate on this score, but it makes it very difficult for physicians like Dr. Ellerbeck to do what he was just now saying. And, that may well indicate that we have a bigger problem in Missouri with regard to these opioid deaths than in other states. That's something that we probably should look into.
But Dr. Ellerbeck, what is the relationship between this demographic and suicide from your perspective? I mean, is this again coming back to the opiates?
Well, it's not just the opiates. The opiates are associated with the chronic pain, and the chronic pain is associated with stress, chronic back pain, et cetera, and depression. So almost anybody who has a chronic pain syndrome also has chronic depression. And we just don't have the best treatments in place. We don't have adequate access to behavioral counseling and support systems. We certainly don't have adequate access to opiate or dependence treatment either.
So underlying causes are really similar for these two.
I think so.
How do physicians talk about this amongst one another?
Well, the volume of the discussion has gone up substantially over the last 4 or 5 years. I think the data that we've seen on the rapid rise of opiate-related deaths really does have physicians talking about this and thinking a little bit more carefully now before they start using the opiates.
What do you think are the challenges in addressing it? I mean, other than we've heard about this lack of a drug database in Missouri, but that doesn't apply. Well, it doesn't apply in Kansas, though a state line does run through our area. But what else? What are some of the other challenges?
Oh, I wish I had an easy answer to this, but it's very, very difficult. I think we have patients who are depressed and dissatisfied, and it would be great if we could get rid of some of the underlying socioeconomic factors. I think would decrease some of the pressure on it. But then we actually need to come up with better behavioral and physical therapy type of techniques to think about chronic pain and to recognize that some people are going to have chronic pain. And what we probably need to focus on is how we can help them function and be productive and feel good about their role in life.
How about the alcohol piece of it? I mean, I don't think any group is immune to problems with alcohol, and it's not a new problem either. Is there something you've been seeing in your practice in recent years that wasn't true in the past when it comes to alcohol abuse?
Actually, I think that was the part that actually did surprise me. So the opiates is very, very obvious because patients come in on a monthly basis to get refills on their prescriptions. The alcohol frequently we don't see until the later stages of life when people are presenting with late-stage complications of that. But there is data to suggest that alcohol consumption on a per capita basis has been progressively increasing since 1992. And now I think with some of the cirrhosis deaths, we're starting to see the effect of that.
Is this larger situation changing the way you look at care?
I think that there's Yes. I think there are a number of trends in the healthcare system that could help with this. I think the ideas of the patient-centered medical home about improving continuity and physician-patient relationships could have a positive impact on this to get people into a more nurturing, healing relationship than instead of shopping around from one doctor to another looking for someone who's going to give a quick fix.
Edward Ellerbeck, thanks so much for your time.
Thank you very much for having me here.
Dan Margulies of Heartland Health Monitor, remind us of some of the discrepancies from one county, one municipality to another.
Well, I'm not sure. You mean with regard to this particular demographic that we've been talking
about? Yes, yes.
I don't know that there are any great disparities. Again, you know, this is a very rough and ready comparison that I was able to make because, as I said, I wasn't able to narrow the parameters to quite what the Deaton case paper is talking about. But I think the more relevant and germane comparison is with, you know, middle-aged blacks and Hispanics, and those rates continue to decline. Now, the black mortality rate is still higher than that of whites, but the gap has been narrowing for years and years, and that continues to happen. So the question, again, is why this particular demographic of middle-aged white Americans, and more particularly males with less than a high school education or less, why are they the ones who are most affected by this?
Jaron St. Ange, do different communities within our region require different approaches to health care based on what you're hearing, or are these statistics quite possibly in part caused by existing differences in approaches and access to health care from one community or another? Another chicken and egg kind of thing.
That's a tough one. I think it's what are these underlying causes? Yes, I think that different groups definitely require different forms of treatment depending on what types of communities you're talking about. If you take something like education, for instance, and you look at the increasing use of alcohol among different education groups, what you find are that those people who have higher levels of education. So let's be clear about this. When we're looking at these mortality rates, we're really talking about this group of high school education or less. That's really who this is impacting. If you look at
whites,
so
you think that's the piece of the statistic that's really germane?
Absolutely. And I think it's that people who have those higher levels of education, I mean, beyond what you're getting from education, you're better able to take advantage of those services that are being offered. So I think that if you have the higher level education, it's really, you're able to benefit much more.
Jaron Saint-Ange, I really appreciate your insights. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
An increase in deaths caused by suicide, alcohol, and drugs speaks to a need for access to mental and behavioral health services. When KCUR's Central Standard returns, we'll address gaps in that type of care. I'm Gina Kaufman. Don't go away. And we're back. I'm Gina Kaufman. You're listening to KCUR's Central Standard, where we've been talking about an increase in the death rate for middle-aged white Americans with a high school education or less. The causes: suicide, alcohol, and drugs all point to mental and behavioral health care needs. So what's going on with those services in our area? First, let's hear for just a minute from Tom Petrizzo. He's on the line from Tri-County Mental Health Services, serving Platte, Clay, and Ray counties. Tom, do you see some of the same things in those counties that our KU Med folks are seeing on the other side of the state line?
Yes. As I was listening to the guests that you had on the show, yeah, we see some of the similar things with folks who are struggling with depression, anxiety, maybe even trying to self-medicate using, you know, drugs and alcohol, because they don't know where to go to get the proper treatment for those mental health conditions. So, yes, we do see that.
Why do people who need help, whose lives might, in fact, it sounds like, be saved by getting help, why do they not get it? What are some of those reasons?
Well, there's a variety of factors. So one is that there's a nationwide, and in Kansas City metro area as well, there's a healthcare shortage of mental health professionals. And what I'm talking about there are licensed counselors as well as psychiatrists who can prescribe medication. The Kansas City metro area has been designated as a mental health shortage area for those professionals by the Department of Health and Human Services in Washington.
Wow.
And then secondly, there's really just a great reluctance or maybe even fear about going to seek treatment for a mental health or behavioral health substance use condition. And that's something that just requires more dialogue, more what would I call prevention and education about those conditions, because they are very, very common and very treatable if, you know, folks would seek out that proper treatment.
Go on.
Oh, and then the last thing I would just say is there's really not a, what would I call it, access to what I would call urgent care for behavioral health, like there might be for, you know, a physical condition.
Like a broken bone.
Right, right. So, it's, you know, you can go to an emergency room with a behavioral health urgent situation, but that group is not as equipped or trained to handle that situation as perhaps a mental health professional or a psychiatrist. So, you know, you see those urgent care centers located around the Kansas City metro area or emergency room, but they're really geared toward physical health care needs. We don't have an urgent care centers for behavioral health. And that would be a great thing if we did at some point, a really great thing.
Well, that does bring me to my next question. I mean, do the services that are available out there match the needs of the community, or are there gaps? I mean, you've pointed to one, either in the offerings themselves or in access to those offerings.
Yeah, I think what I'm highlighting, Gina, is just the gaps of what exists right now, which would be more accessible services 24 hours a day for those urgent situations, because that's where the gap, I think, really is, because there's lots of research about folks who are struggling with depression or other mental health conditions and considering hurting themselves or committing suicide. There's always a time of ambivalence right before they actually proceed to, you know, either try to commit suicide or do something else. And if you can intervene at that moment, or there was a place for people to go when that moment of ambivalence is occurring, then there would be perhaps less likelihood of people committing suicide and dying earlier.
Mm-hmm. Tom Petrizzo, thank you so much for sharing your insights on this.
Sure. I appreciate it. Thank you for having me on.
Let's turn now to our in-studio guest, Dan Margulies, KCUR's health editor, is still here. And Dan, you've noticed that on the one hand, some new sort of high-end for-profit treatment facilities are headed to our area. Meanwhile, public facilities are shutting their doors. Lay it out for us.
Sure.
I mean, what's going on?
Yeah, I mean, it is a really fascinating phenomenon, Gina. There's long been a shortage of psychiatric services for the general population in this area, and that includes affluent areas like Johnson County. You know, we did a story a couple of months ago that quoted the sheriff of Johnson County, Frank Denning, as saying that 17% of the inmates in the Johnson County jail have been diagnosed as having a serious and persistent mental illness. I mean, so we're warehousing people who should be getting treatment in a hospital or medical setting in jails. Now, we have a problem with the state hospitals in the state of Kansas. There are two state mental hospitals, one in Osawatomie and one in Larned, and both of them are terribly understaffed at the moment. And in addition, we're just having big problems in Osawatomie. The federal government has imposed all kinds of restrictions on it because it has inadequate staffing and it has too many patients. They've limited voluntary admissions to the hospital until they can get the situation under control. So as you point out, in the meantime, some for-profit operators have stepped into the void, most recently in Olathe, a for-profit company based in I believe it's Tennessee or maybe it's Kentucky. I forget now. Opened up its doors. It's a gorgeous facility. I actually toured it a couple of months ago. It's called Cottonwood Springs, and it's just off of I-35, and it's a 72-bed facility for mental health patients as well as substance abuse patients. And they say they're going to take on all comers, including the uninsured. We'll see about that. But they opened just weeks after Truman Medical Centers in downtown Kansas City closed its mental health emergency ward, ostensibly because the government told it that it needed to staff it at the same levels as its other emergency rooms, which it said was not feasible.
Well, let's hear now from Molly O'Neill. She's with us from First Call, serving individuals who are struggling with substance abuse disorders as well as family members who are affected by a loved one's use. Hi, Molly.
Hi, Gina.
So you've been involved in behavioral health in this city for 23 years. In that time period, how would you say that the overall landscape for care has changed?
Well, it's contracted. You know, it's really shrinking. We are on the good news side, we're looking at much more high-quality services. The services that are being provided are evidence-based and are really effective. But the access, as we've been hearing all around the conversation, access to those services is going down because of a lack of resources. And you know, the other piece is that the systems are very, very difficult to negotiate. Folks who – the population we're talking about with a lower level of education and lower socioeconomic base are – have a harder time negotiating those systems. And so, you know, a big piece is for us to get in there and be supportive of folks along the way in their process, and but that takes a little bit more one-on-one time. It takes some activity that that it, on the surface looks more expensive. Now, if you look at the high-cost systems that we're talking about in terms of emergency room and emergent care, that for all of the ancillary effects of substance use disorders and other behavioral health issues, and you really compare longer term the cost, providing more chronic health care is much more cost effective over time.
What's the current thinking in your field about how to reach demographics with behavioral and health care needs that aren't being met for one reason or another?
You know, I think we have always long focused on removing barriers. It's not always the systemic approach, meaning there's a lot of bureaucracy involved. The population that we're talking about are not necessarily the folks who have health insurance, they may work at jobs that they can't get away from those jobs. It's much easier to take an opioid and be able to just go to work than it is to go to physical therapy three times a week. So there's some challenges and barriers within the systems that we have.
Especially like an hourly wage. Yeah,
right.
Missing that work. Yeah.
Right. And, you know, there is parity now that we're talking about health insurance having to cover behavioral health issues in the same manner that they cover health physical health issues, but which are, frankly, the same thing. But the rules are not fully enforced, and that's not fully implemented yet. But the other piece of that is that folks who are underinsured or uninsured who could take advantage of Medicaid, where, you know, we in our states have not taken advantage of the expansion of that. So that's really problematic as well.
Does the stigma of getting help come into play here? And if so, how do you get over that hump? I mean, that's deeply ingrained.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I think that, you know, the negative public perceptions are really impactful from system-wide. It really creates a challenge just in terms of having availability of service. You know, if we understood this to be an illness as a public, as a general population,
where we people could like speak up and say, "I'd use that. I could use that."
Yeah, we would have a lot more service. You know, if I used my doctor to go to get help for a substance use disorder like I do for the flu, you know, and people didn't wince, you know, then we would see people accessing services a lot better.
Marcia Epstein is a social worker in Lawrence who specializes in suicide prevention and bereavement support. And I'd like to get her in on this. Marcia, do you see gaps in access to behavioral and mental health care services out in Douglas County, either the same ones we've been discussing in the Kansas City area or different ones?
Well, I'm going to answer your question more broadly in that I've done a lot of work across the state nationally in suicide prevention, and I'm also involved with a project with Truman Behavioral Health and Wyandotte Behavioral Health there in the Kansas City area. Are there problems with access to care? Yes, but there's another level of problem, which is there is no requirement that any of those providers of care have any particular training in reducing suicide risk. Okay. Well, if we think about what happens, we're told things like, well, you know, if there's an emergency, if somebody's suicidal, call 911 or talk to your pastor or talk to your primary care doctor or make an appointment with a therapist or go to the hospital emergency department, those kinds of things. But in the training for those positions and the licensing for those positions, there is no requirement that those providers have any training in reducing suicide risk. And so we're in a country where, in a time in the world where a lot has been learned about what's effective, but it's not in place. So we're challenged in that. And I also need to take this to a more personal level.
Yeah, please.
We've heard a lot of information. We've heard a lot of data. We've heard a lot of important ideas about what contributes to the higher rates of deaths in this particular population. But when it comes to suicide, one of the things that we know is that there are multiple factors that contribute to an adult dying by suicide. It's not one thing. And it has to do in part with the meaning we make of experiences, but it also has to do with who we are, kind of how we're wired in terms of how we're affected by things. You know, I think about in my own experience, I do a lot of work and have for many years in suicide prevention and bereavement support, but I'm also a person out in the world. I've lost people I know to suicide. I lost somebody this summer who fits in the demographic that you're talking about, but I wouldn't say that his education level, his race, or his age were the contributors to his death by suicide. I would say for him, it had to do with things that started in early childhood as being a child who was basically abandoned and then was later adopted into a family, and trying to figure out his place in the world, went into the military at a young age, came out of the military after 20 plus years, and still tried to find sort of his place in the world, while at the same time also having a family, lots of responsibilities, friends. You know, there are lots of different things about every certain one who has died by these different causes. You know, when we talk about things that might have been caused by excessive alcohol or other drugs or suicide. And I keep thinking we need to be thinking about people and what do people need and what can each person who's listening do? Because the truth is everybody can make a difference, you know?
Yeah, it is such an almost crass thing to think about something as personal as a mental health issue, and particularly something like suicide, from a large scale demographic, statistics, numbers based perspective. From the individual perspective, I mean, or from any perspective, really, do you think the solution lies in the behavioral healthcare community, or do we have to look beyond your profession to really address this problem?
It has to be something everybody is aware of and involved with. That's the message. When we look at some like basic things about what is known about people who die by suicide, one way of looking at that was really identified by a researcher, clinician, and also survivor of his dad's death by suicide, a man named Thomas Joyner, highly esteemed in suicide prevention. And Thomas's work identified there are three things that when they overlap, these really identify people at high risk or people who have died by suicide. One of them you can't do anything about, and that one is called acquired capability. That means if somebody has in their own life, for whatever combinations of reasons, been exposed to things that harm the body, which could mean a surgical nurse, could mean somebody who's been in combat, could mean somebody who's lived in a very violent environment, could be somebody who has attempted suicide or used self-harm. But there are things that desensitize us to doing bodily harm.
And like the sanctity of the body has already been in some way disturbed.
Yeah, you have to be able to do it. Not everybody is able. And some people recognize that about themselves, that no matter how bad things are, they can't imagine that they could ever do something to end their own lives. The other two things are things that we can all make a difference with. One of those is the perception of being a burden, which a lot of us would say has to do also with feelings of shame, that we have an idea that there's something wrong with us and that people would be better off without us, that it'd be easier for them to deal with our death than with our life. So we can do things with people. And I'm talking person to person, not just behavioral health.
Right.
We can help people feel involved and connected. Because the other thing, the third one, is feeling like one doesn't belong, you know? So when you have people who are socially isolated, who are struggling with some things about themselves that they think are really wrong, then those people are at risk. And one of the things that we're learning more and more about, and there's a great program in the Kansas City community, is about bringing the art to people, getting people involved with arts, particularly arts like spoken word poetry, that people share messages and connect and get involved. And so there are lots of innovative ways of helping people break down those ideas of I don't belong and I'm a burden. There are also things that have to happen within our behavioral health system and our primary care systems. There's a national model called Zero Suicide that came out of work at the Henry Ford Clinic in Detroit, where they literally went through years where they were able to get the suicide death rates of people in their care system to zero. They couldn't stay totally at zero, but the dramatic decrease. And right now in Kansas City, there's a project with Truman Behavioral Health and Wyandotte Behavioral Health, spearheaded by Bill Geis, who's a professor in the School of Medicine at UMKC, funded in part by a grant from the Healthcare Foundation of Greater Kansas City. And the idea of Zero Suicide is basically top to bottom systems change.
Yeah.
Policies, procedures, and training everywhere so that you really get people the help that they need that's known to be helpful.
Well, our time...
Yes. Yeah, we're done.
We are. I'm
just
so
smile
sorry.
And be kinder, and that makes a difference too.
Our time is up for today's show. So much important information, so little time. Molly O'Neill, President and CEO of First Call, thank you for your time today.
Thank you, Gina.
And social worker Marcia Epstein, I appreciate this so much.
Thanks, Gina.
Dan Margulies of the Heartland Health Monitor, thanks for your reporting and your time.
My pleasure, Gina.
You can listen back to this discussion at kcur.org/centralstandard. We've included links to resources for help with addiction and depression issues alongside the audio for today's show. That's kcur.org/centralstandard. Sign up for our podcast while you're there. We love talking to our listeners on Twitter, so follow us there and hit us up anytime. We're at KCURCST, and I'm at Gina KCUR. KCUR's Central Standard is produced by Matthew Long Middleton and Sylvia Maria Gross. I'm Gina Kaufman. Up to Date is right around the corner, so keep listening.